All right, so when analyzing supplemental jurisdiction, you look at Statute 28 USC 1367. Here there is a three-step analysis. The first one, does the claim have its own independent subject matter jurisdiction? If yes, you don't need supplemental jurisdiction. If no, then under 1367A, does the claim have a common nucleus of operative facts that we ordinarily accept the claims tried in one proceeding? If yes, then 1367A is satisfied. There is a supplemental jurisdiction. Third one is, although A is satisfied, does the claim fall under 1367B's exception? The 1367B analysis is, does the claim arise under federal question or diversity? If federal question, then B's exceptions don't apply. If diversity, is the plaintiff joining the claim or is the defendant? If the defendant, 1367B exceptions don't apply. If the plaintiff is joining a claim against a person made a party through Rule 14, 19, 20, or 24. If no, 1367B exceptions don't apply. 1367B exceptions will never preclude a claim made through an impleader by a defendant. The court will have supplemental jurisdiction. We then move on to informal investigation and scope of discovery. The purpose is to narrow and classify issues, ascertaining facts and information, limit surprise at trial, and increase efficiency and reduce costs. In informal discovery, you hire an investigator to speak with witnesses or take a picture of an accident scene. Formal discoveries are depositions, interrogatories, documents, and requests. All right, we then move on to the scope of discovery set out by Rule 26B1. This is also known as the attorney-client privilege. You may obtain discovery regarding any matter not privileged that is relevant to the claim or defense of any party. So basically, for the good cause shown, a court can allow discovery of any matter relevant to the subject matter involved. The information needs to be admissible to be discoverable as long as the information is reasonably calculated to lead the discovery of admissible evidence. Now, there are common objections to discovery, which are irrelevant under Rule 26b1, attorney-client privilege, work product, which is 26b3, and 26b2c, which is material requested is cumulative, is available elsewhere, or is unduly burdened. Attorney-client privilege is any communication made between privileged persons in confidence for the purpose of obtaining or providing legal assistance for the client. Now, keep in mind that facts can't be shielded from discovery merely but made by communicating them to an attorney. The burden rests on the party invoking the privilege. The types of work that's covered under Rule 12b6-3, work product production, are materials under other than underlying facts prepared in anticipation of litigation, can obtain work product material under certain circumstances in Rule 26b3a. Which is a primary purpose approach, a document that would have been prepared even when no litigation is anticipated, usually for business purposes, would not qualify for work product production. The basic methods of formal discovery is Rule 26, initial disclosure, Rule 33, which is interrogatories, Rule 30, depositions, and Rule 34, production of documents. There's also, mandatory disclosures under Rule 26A, which there's four categories. The first one, if it helps support the party's claim or defense, then you must disclose identity and contract information to anyone likely to have discoverable information unless the use is solely for impeachment. Number two, if it helps to support the party's claim or defense, then it must disclose a copy of documents, electronically stored info, and intangible objects, unless used is solely for impeachment. Number three is computation of damages, unless privileged or protected from disclosure. And number four is insurance agreement. We then move on to state law in federal courts, i.e., the Erie Doctrine. All right, so the president is Swift v. Tyson, which under Swift, federal courts must follow the statutes but not the state common law. We then move on to the Erie decision, which was Erie Company versus Topskin. Someone was injured by a train in Pennsylvania. The state laws apply in federal court when issue does not involve constitution, federal law, or treaty. That is a rule. When issue does not relate to federal law, treaty, or federal constitution, the federal court must follow the state statutes and common law. There's no such thing as federal common law. You must use the state's common law. Now, when there is no common law, you must use the predictive approach, which federal courts ask what rule the state's highest courts would apply today if any older cases have been applied in a different rule. There's also the choice of law rule, in which state courts use choice of law rules to determine which state's substantive law to use. We then move on to depositions without trial, which is summary judgment under Rule 56A. The court shall grant judgment even if the movement shows that there is no genuine dispute as to material facts and the movement is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. This comes at the end of discovery. So just keep in mind that the movement must show there is no genuine issue of material facts, and a material fact being a fact that would make a difference in the case. The case in this section was Slavin v. City of Salem, where the plaintiff was asserting the defendant knew or should have known that the plaintiff was a suicide. In order for summary judgment to be denied, there must be a dispute as to the material fact, not into a dispute of. Also, remember that the courts have rejected the scintilla of evidence theory, and that it is possible to obtain partial summary judgment as to some of the elements of the claim or as to liability as opposed to damage. And then there's judgment as a matter of law, or directed verdict and JNOV, which is Rule 50A. Motions for judgment as a matter of law, formerly known as motions for directed verdict, where an attorney must present why it should get a Rule 50A motion. Here you analyze whether a reasonable jury would not have a legally sufficient evidentiary basis to find for the party or an issue on which the party has been fully heard in light most favorable to the non-moving party. Here, a party can make more than once, a Rule 50A motion. Yeah, more than once during the same trial. Sorry. If the evidence is conflicting, the court should deny the motion and let the jury decide. All right, so for the motion for directed verdict, must typically wait until the non-moving party has presented all of his evidence on the issue. The court will grant if no reasonable jury could find in favor of the non-moving party after considering all of the evidence. So the last and final issue or thing that we talked about was claim preclusion, the elements, same claim, evidence transaction, and primary test. Parties are identical or in privity. Final judgment on the merits, the court of competent jurisdiction. In determining if a prior judgment is final, valid, or on the merits, if it's valid, the original court had a proper jurisdiction over the case, subject matter jurisdiction. If the issue of jurisdiction is not litigated or appealed, then the court will go by the original judgment. A final judgment is one where the federal court, it is final when the trial court is done with the case, even if it's on appeal. Courts typically await the completion of appeal before determining if claim preclusion apply. On the merits is policy, only fair to preclude claim if the party had an opportunity to have the substance of it heard. Basically had an opportunity for the substance of the suit to be heard, there was improper venue or subject matter jurisdiction. So just keep in mind that plain preclusion is a rule that a final judgment on the merits by a court having jurisdiction is conclusive between the parties to a suit as to all the matters that were litigated or that could have been litigated in the suit. The U.S. legal system places high value on allowing a party to litigate a civil suit for money damages only once. So basically, it's like the civil way of double jeopardy. And lastly, there are six categories of a non-party preclusion that courts mention. Basically, one is agreement to be bound by a previous case, two, substantive relationship between the person to be bound and the party of judgment, a non-party who assumed control,